Terry Lee Hankins is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Stay with us as we discuss capital punishment and witness the 200th legal homicide under Governor Perry in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Dr. Dennis Longmire, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special reports from cities where protesters are marking Governor Perry's grim milestone. The Execution Watch begins.
Good evening. This is Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch for June the 2nd, 2009. Terry Hankins is scheduled to be executed in just a few minutes. Elizabeth will connect us with the demonstrators outside of the walls in Huntsville, who will give us a report on what's going on there. My name is Ray Hill, and you're listening to KPFT HD2 channel. Using the high-definition channels on KPFT affords us extra programming time, and I think this is the only live program currently being done on this radio station on an HD channel. Those of you with that equipment, congratulations, you can hear us well if you're within the broadcast footprint of KPFT. If not, those of you with computers around the world, and we have many international listeners to this show, this is the only one-hour broadcast time that is devoted to an execution in Texas each time it occurs. If you're listening on the radio, you can get another version of it at executionwatch.org, and all of our previous programs are archived on executionwatch.org so that you can listen to them at your convenience. With me is going to be Jim Skelton. We're going to have reports from Gloria Ruback at a downtown demonstration, because this is the 200th execution warrant signed by Governor Rick Perry of Texas since he became governor due to the election of George W. Bush to the White House. We have Charles Perrault from Montreal joining us, and Laura Brady in Austin. Scott Cobb, who is also in Huntsville, but tonight's report will come from Dennis Longmire. Dave Atwood is standing by here in Houston for a demonstration, because every time there is an execution, there are demonstrations in Houston, Huntsville, frequently Austin, and San Antonio. And I can tell from the pitter-patter of her little feet that Elizabeth, our producer, is here. Hello, this is Ray Hill. Dennis,
hey, this is Dennis Longmire.
Are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. What's going on?
We saw the witnesses for the media go into the building about 5 minutes ago. There has not been another group of witnesses cross the street, so it's very, very possible that there are no witnesses for tonight for
Terry?
Terry Lee Hankins. Hankins, correct.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anyone else go in. There are about 40 people here on the corner. A large group of people from Stephen F. Austin have come under the coordination of a group of students there. There's also a group of here representing Children Against the Death Penalty, and they're holding a very large, call it a banner, if you will. It's a large cord with crosses, and on each cross there is the name of one of the 200 people who have been executed by under the watch of Governor Perry. So it's a different than normal.
It's somewhat unusual to have 40 people at a demonstration in Huntsville.
Very unusual, very unusual. In fact, we've got people here from Switzerland, and we've got people from Michigan, and we've got people from Nacogdoches, and I'll bet that I'm the only one from Huntsville. And
other than the students.
A couple more. Okay, four or five of us from Huntsville.
Okay. Dennis, you will get back in touch with Elizabeth if there are further developments.
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing you.
You'll get back in touch with Elizabeth if there are further developments.
Very good.
Thank you. And that's Professor Dennis Longmire, who teaches criminal justice at Sam Houston State University. And Dennis is a faithful. He goes to the walls every time there is an execution. Death row is actually in Livingston, Texas. Those to be executed when they go on death watch are transported to the walls in Huntsville. And now it's time. Jim?
Yeah.
This is a pretty bad dude.
Well, I can see why there's no witnesses. He killed everybody in his family, so there's no one left
there's
to see.
There's no one left to come see him die.
Killed them all.
Right. I commented earlier that it sounds very much like a Fort Worth case.
Let me tell you what I find think is real odd about this. First off, he killed his girlfriend or wife, ex-wife, we call her what she may.
They had the same last name.
Right, and he killed her in her sleep. So it wasn't an argument, it wasn't anything. Killed her first, and he went back, and she had a 12-year-old boy and a 13-year-old girl. And he shot and killed both of them in their sleep. So there was no, usually in a murder like this, there's a big family argument, someone gets beat up, and they lose their head and kill somebody. Apparently there's nothing like this going on. He killed all three of them and killed the mother first, went back later and killed the two children, all of them as they slept.
And when they busted him, they found out?
Well, what happened?
He told them.
After what happened, after he got arrested, he took his wife, the dead lady's car, and went to his girlfriend, and apparently had another lady on the side. And I looked him up when I saw how he had all these women. He's a little fat, short guy, and I was amazed. And he goes over to his girlfriend's apartment, and that's where they find the car. And so when the police arrive around 2 in the morning, he sends his girlfriend out and see if anything unusual is going on. She encounters the police who are looking at the car. And she tells him he's in the apartment, that he has a shotgun and another pistol. And like a 5-hour standoff later, the police arrest him. After they arrest him, they take him in front of a magistrate. He gets a Miranda warning. Within 8 hours, he's confessed to the police. Later on, he gave 3 confessions, one to the media. But the more unusual thing, he confessed that about a year earlier, he'd shot and killed his father. So the police go to the father's place and find him dead in a lounge chair in a recliner inside of a trailer house with air fresheners all around him.
Mm-hmm.
And he also admitted that he killed his half-sister who he'd impregnated, and they found her body in a nice chest in a father's shed. Hit her in the head with the tire jack and shot and killed the father. And again, in all the case law I read, I looked up everything I could find from the Court of Criminal Appeals in the Fifth Circuit, even checked the Fort Worth and Dallas papers. There was never any indication why he killed his father, why he killed his stepsister.
He wasn't even trying for that.
No, he was only tried for the death of the two children. That's something he was tried for and tried and convicted for that.
Is that normal situation when someone is a multiple killer that they only try them for a limited number of cases?
Yeah, they hold one back in case they don't get the death penalty. They can have another shot at him.
Okay.
And another thing I thought in this, and I've told lawyers this time and time again, all these killings occurred in mobile home park, and I've often said that lawyers ought to build a shrine in mobile home parks. If it wasn't for mobile homes, incest, the Baptist church, there'd be no crime. I'm just telling you that Texas would be crime-free.
Crime-free. And Fort Worth has something to do with it.
Oh, yeah.
The strangest cases
that
are happening.
That's that Fort Worth area. There's something in the water up there that makes people crazy.
Well, you know what is interesting about this case is its timing. This execution is happening today. This is the 200th death warrant signed by Governor Perry, and of all of the people to come due for execution, this is
the worst.
This is absolutely the best example to justify the death penalty.
Absolutely.
It's really unusual for there to be 200 people killed in one administration.
Not in Texas, it isn't.
Well, I don't know of any other governor that's killed 200 people.
But no one's been governor as long as he has.
Oh, okay. That's
the reason. Believe me, Georgia.
The governor that was here that wanted to.
You're off mic, so
yeah.
Kill it.
You know one governor was here that wanted to.
Yeah. And so we've got this case. Is that there wasn't much to appeal in this case.
Let me tell you the most, there's no, from a lawyer's viewpoint, there was a lot to appeal. Let me tell you what I found was really, really interesting. And I thought it was a good argument. He argued that the death penalty statute was unconstitutional because there was no statewide standard on how to seek the death penalty. Every individual prosecutor has their own standard.
Hmm.
Now, here's what's real interesting about that. And this is what I found to be real interesting. Years ago, policemen were real bad about setting up roadblocks to catch people at DWIs. That was declared unconstitutional because there was no statewide policy on roadblocks. And the Supreme Court said until there's a statewide policy on roadblocks, we're not going to have each individual municipality deciding when to set up a roadblock. And they said a statewide system should have some sort of standards. Well, it seems to me the same thing should be true of the death penalty. They give more credence and more due process, to roadblocks and killing people.
Execution.
And I think that's an extremely good argument, that it depends on what part of the state, whether your DA is a mad dog or not, whether you get the death penalty or not, because that's a major...
Well, that's obvious and literally true.
Well, the major reason, for example, Harris County has had more death penalties than any place else is not because people here are meaner, because our prosecutors assault them more. We've had a police mentality in the DA's office up until recently. Because when Chuck Rosenthal and Johnny Holmes were DAs, they were more cops and lawyers. And that's the reason there's more death penalties in Houston, not because people here are meaner, because the DA assault them more. And I thought that was a great argument. So what he had done, he had subpoenaed the DAs from 12 different counties for them to discuss their different policies on seeking the death penalty. And they all filed motions to quash the subpoenas. And then the Supreme Court, I mean, the Court of Criminal Appeals just promptly flushed the argument because they wouldn't, first off, they wouldn't let the DAs testify. And what the Court of Criminal Appeals did, they hid behind that stupid idea that prosecutors have unfettered discretion. Well, by the same token, don't police have unfettered discretion to set up roadblocks?
Sure.
And they give more credence to setting up roadblocks and seeking the death penalty in this state.
Well, so his lawyers did a credible job.
You want to talk, Dan? You're back.
No, I'm looking at your factual deal here.
Okay. Anyway, and another thing I thought was real interesting, this is kind of a unique thing. It's not unique. Now, you're always hearing these people yell about technicalities in law.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of technicalities that work the other way, and this is a good example of one. When they arrested him, within 9 hours after his arrest, they got a confession. And then what happened, he said that the arrest was unlawful because he was arrested without a warrant. There was a warrant issue, but the warrant didn't state probable cause. And what a lot of people don't realize, when an arrest warrant is issued, it's like a search warrant. They've got to have probable cause to issue an arrest warrant. Here they didn't have probable cause. As a result of the arrest, he gave the first confession.
Mm-hmm.
So he tried to attack the first confession as being the fruit of an unlawful arrest. Now, here's where the technicalities work for the state. There's a concept in law called the attenuation doctrine. And it came out of a case called Brown versus Illinois. And what it basically says, courts will look at four different factors to see whether or not the taint of the unlawful arrest has been removed. One of the things they look at is whether Miranda warnings were given prior to the confession. Well, here, he was taken to a magistrate, gave Miranda warnings, and the detectives gave Miranda warnings. So that meant that weight on the side of the state in attenuating the confession or making sure the taint had been removed. Second thing to look at is the time between the illegal arrest and the confession was given. You're talking about 9.5 hours. And they said that was kind of a none factor. And the third thing you'd look is what they call intervening circumstances. And they said since he was warned by a magistrate, very carefully told what his charges were, asked if he wanted a lawyer appointed. And he said no, he didn't want one. That was an intervening factor that removed the unlawfulness of the arrest. And then the fourth factor to look at is the flagrancy of police misconduct. And here there was no misconduct on the part of the police as far as any claim that they'd abused him.
So in spite of the fact that he confessed right away and he confessed to the media, his lawyer did try to find some arguments to do in the appeal.
Absolutely, because they argued that first confession was inadmissible. And then what you argue, once if you can knock out the first confession, what you then got to show is the following confessions were a continuation of the first, and therefore that unlawfulness carries through. But the Court of Criminal Appeals sidestepped all that simply by saying, using what they call the attenuation doctrine, and saying that the illegality of the arrest had been removed because of the Miranda warning, the judge giving him a warning, and the time frame wasn't that great.
So they did spend some money and tear down some trees in this case.
Oh, absolutely. And also they had some of the arguments they made at the Court of Criminal Appeals were kind of specious about. They had a whole bunch of stuff about on the mitigating issue, who should have the burden of proof. That's been settled years ago. Nobody does. They had a lot of the standard, what we call boilerplate death penalty arguments. Mm-hmm. But the one about the statewide policy and the fact and the confession, they did a good job on that. Of course, they didn't have much to work with. Again, there's that old phrase, bad facts make bad law, and I don't think there's any way in the world. After he admits killing five people, and apparently, for no apparent reason, killing the latter three, that they're ever going to turn him loose.
Well, I mean, there was never any question about his getting loose, I don't think. I think because of the nature and the seriousness of the crime. But the death penalty still cost, what was that, the jurisdiction of Fort Worth, the state of Texas? Who paid that?
Who fought
his appeals?
Oh, I don't know who the lawyers were.
No, who would pay for that? Would that be the county itself?
They were appointed, yeah. What happened in that particular district, if there's more than one county that makes up the district, money from those various counties would go into a fund because to pay a court-appointed lawyer. Plus, so here's how it works. On a death penalty case, the state pays for the lawyer on trial, mm-hmm. pays for the lawyer on direct appeal. After that, you're on your own. If you want to do a writ after that in federal and state court, you've got to get agencies or people volunteer to do that. Except here recently, they've gotten some funding from the Court of Criminal Appeals to do state writs. So basically, these counties pay for the lawyer. The counties pay for the direct appeal. And that's another reason Harris County's had more of them. It's a wealthier county. And some of these smaller counties, they simply can't afford it. It would break them. No, it would break them to try a death penalty case. So Harris County... County's never had a budget restraints placed upon the DA's office. There's never any budget restraints, and so they've been able to kill who they wanted to kill.
And so when we say that it costs more in a death penalty case than it does for someone to get life in prison, it is because of the expense of all of these lawyers and all this litigation. Did he have litigation, or did he file appeals other than his direct appeal?
What happened, he filed a state writ, and then he filed a federal writ, did cert on both of them. First off, here's the procedure. He was convicted, court-appointed lawyer, mm-hmm. direct appeal, court-appointed lawyer, mm-hmm. filed a writ for certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court. That was denied. That ended the direct appeal. Thereafter, he filed a state post-conviction writ.
Probably, where did those lawyers come from?
Probably the Court of Criminal Appeals helped pay for that. There's a fund they put together to help pay for those writ lawyers. That was denied. They had a hearing at the trial level, but the hearing was done by affidavit. And one of the real interesting things about those post-conviction writs, Dan Grunson gave me a real interesting article about one out of 860-something writs are granted. And I'm not sure they read those writs because you cannot, there's not, when you start looking at the web page, what the Court of Criminal Appeals kicks out during 1 week and the number of writs they deny, you'll see 30 or 40. They cannot read them, I promise you. And Dan had given me that article about that the writ procedure here in Texas is kind of a joke because the way a writ works is you file it in the district court where you're convicted, and the district court judge either has an evidentiary hearing or he'll hear it on what he calls affidavits, and he sends a record up to the Court of Criminal Appeals, then makes the decision. Mm-hmm. One out of 860 was granted last year, and that's almost absurd, so why bother filing the damn things? And so what happened, he filed a state writ, that was denied. Then he files a writ in federal district court, and what his issue at that point was that his lawyer was ineffective. And frankly, there's no way a lawyer, I don't care who you'd hire with this set of facts, three confessions.
The lawyer said there wasn't much he could do.
Well, you can sit there and say, repeat after me, our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. That's about the best shot you got. Or hope to be the jury marijuana-laced cookies and hope for the best. That would be your only hope in a case like this. And so you can imagine his claim the lawyer is ineffective. They're going to say, well, look at my client. What could I have done? You know,
right.
I had an ineffective client is what they're going to say. And so there's no way in the world. And so what happened? The federal district court denied the writ, and federal district court's different than state court. In order to get to the Fifth Circuit, you got to have a certificate of appealability, meaning that the district court, and this is kind of bizarre, district court rules against you, but the district court's got to certify that there's an issue that may get him reversed, therefore you're, and he's not going to say that he wouldn't have ruled against you. It's called a certificate of appealability. Mm-hmm. And district court denied him a certificate of appealability to the Fifth Circuit, and Fifth Circuit affirmed the district court. And that was pretty much it. Now, he doesn't have successive writs like you see when the issue of executing mentally retarded people came up. A lot of people went back on second writs. He didn't do that in this case. We never claimed that.
Well, now, these crimes actually happened in this century.
Yeah.
And so this is a pretty quick...
2001.
So this is what, 8 years later?
Yeah.
And he's being executed. That's pretty expeditious.
It's real expeditious.
And is there anything that can, any conclusions can be drawn from that other than the fact that he says, I'm a bad dude and I don't care what I did. I'm guilty of incest and multiple murders.
Bad facts and good lawyering. Because there's nothing left. And the worst, in fact, the worst thing that will happen to most appellate lawyers have a great defense lawyer at trial. Yeah. There's nothing to appeal. Remember the other real quick one that was a streamlined case was Larry O'Brien, the candy killer.
Yeah.
And Marvin Teague was his trial lawyer.
Yeah.
And the reason that went so smooth and quick, there was nothing to appeal.
Marvin did a good job.
And in this case, these lawyers did a good job as you could possibly do. When you sit in a case like that, if you're the lawyer, you're just hoping, I don't want to get the death penalty too, but sitting beside him is what you're hoping. You want to kind of keep that, killing on at least on one side of the table.
Okay, and so we have Dennis. And Dennis, you have something more to report.
Yes, all of the witnesses who went in have now come out. It does appear that there were no witnesses for Terry Lee. And so we are right now in prayer and just waiting.
Okay, and you still have a pretty good-sized crowd there.
Yes, there are still probably about 40 people or more here. And right now everybody is in prayer.
Okay, and this crowd was not as rowdy as the one that was up there. That is in my documentary. These are quiet folks, and the guards aren't nervous or upset, are they?
That's correct, yes. I don't think that there is anyone here who is directly connected with Mr. Hankins.
Yeah.
All of the people here are opposing the death penalty. Some of them have pen pals and are visiting in on death row.
Yeah, I know. We had a couple of ladies from Switzerland on the show Friday. And they would probably be there.
Yes, they are here. And there's another group from Switzerland. There are actually two different groups of Swiss visitors from LifeSpark, the group that I'm familiar with.
Well, Professor Longmire, we appreciate your vigilance and give our regards to the other vigilants at that demonstration.
I shall do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And now what happens is Elizabeth gets in touch with the other demonstrators around the city and the state, and we report to them that the process is complete. Now, I've thought of a lot about how to use those words. Terry Hankins is dead. The state killed him. That's over with. He had no friends to witness his execution, and as Jim Skelton pointed out, he didn't have any relatives left to witness his execution. So the witnesses were from relatives for his victims, but they would not have come through the same process as witnesses for him. So he may have had some relatives over on the other side who came in earlier and was in the execution chamber. We don't have another execution scheduled until July. It seems as if Texas has decided to take a summer break from executions, and so we get a little reprieve in June. And I understand from the rumor mill that Kenneth Mosley, who's scheduled to be executed on July 16th, stands a reasonably credible chance of getting a stay. And of course, this program does not exist if there is a stay. We have run across a situation where there was a last-minute stay, at which time we continue with the program and it becomes a breaking news story about that stay. You're listening to KPFT HD2 channel. I'm Ray Hill, and we're going to continue our conversation with Jim Skelton. So this was really a remarkable case in that the issues that were raised Okay, we've got Laura. Laura, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and you're in Austin. Whereabouts in Austin?
We are down at the Capitol. Specifically, we're on the south side steps. Traffic is winding past us. We're getting a lot of honks of support for being out here.
Okay, now when you say south side steps, you mean way down at the end of the long walk to the Capitol building where there's actually cars.
Yes, right in front of the gate. We are at the cross section here at 11th Street in Congress.
Okay, how many folks?
Traffic on their way home.
How many folks have showed up?
We got about 50 people, 50 supporters out here. Got about four or five different abolition groups represented, which is fantastic. We're all coming together, and we've had a lot of media support.
Well, I've got the sad news to report. The process has been completed with Mr. Hankins.
We unfortunately received that news about 5 minutes ago. What we did is the TC80P does the ceremony of lighting the candle, and of course, as they blow it out to represent the loss of life, they ring the bell. They did the 199 names beforehand as part of the ceremony. And, you know, the fight continues. This is not something that we wanted to see. But like I said, we've been getting a lot of support against the death penalty as a whole today.
Well, Professor Longmire reported having about 40 people in Huntsville. That was a large turnout. You've got about 50 people in Austin. What organization are you with?
I'm a member of the Campaign to End the Death Penalty of the Austin chapter here.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been since I've lived in Austin for about 5 years now.
Tell us about the organization, and if you have a website that you can give, please do that.
Of course. Our national website is nodeathpenalty.org. And, of course, we're a national organization with local chapters. I belong to that Austin local chapter. And we're just a grassroots organization that opposes the death penalty from a very political perspective, being that we recognize that it is racist. We recognize that it targets the poor, that it does not deter crime, that it constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. We take a pretty wild stance on, you know, getting out there and getting our voices heard.
Understand that you had a very good bill about law of parties that there was a lot of misinformation about at the last days of the session.
Yes. You know, I'm proud of how far that bill went. I was, of course, very sad to see it not get called on the Senate floor. But that bill was in light of my pen pal and my friend, Kenneth Foster, who received a commutation in August of 2007. He, of course, was a law of parties case where he was on death row for driving a car. He was not the trigger man. He was 80 feet away. And, of course, I was part of the Save Kenneth Foster coalition that worked to get his commutation, which was won a mere 2 hours before his execution.
He got gubernatorial
clemency. The reason I speak so much of him is because that bill, the Law of Parties bill, was, of course, named after him.
Okay. Well, listen, give our regards to the folks who are demonstrating there, and we appreciate your work, and our regards to your organization for their efforts.
Thanks, Ray, and thanks, Elizabeth, and you guys keep doing what you're doing because you're appreciated.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right. Bye.
And that was Laura Brady. She is in Austin. We've had reports from Dennis Longmire in Huntsville and Laura Brady. There are a couple of other folks that we're going to try to gather up. Gloria Ruback is downtown having a demonstration at the Hanging Tree on the occasion. She had a little problem with the sound system. The officers came by and told her she couldn't use it, and we had a few words, but apparently they weren't going to arrest anybody, so I left early and came to the station to do this show. My name is Ray Hill. You're listening to Execution Watch, either live on KPFT HD2 channel or live on executionwatch.org. We're glad to have you with us. Every time Texas does an execution, we do this show. Wait a minute. Here's Elizabeth back. We have someone else on. Okay, let's, okay. No. Okay, so we're ready to move on to the next one. Who've we got? We've got a Canadian, Charles Perrod. Perrod. Charles.
Hey.
Pronounce your name Perud?
Sort of. Yeah, that's Swiss.
Oh, okay. Well, give me a better pronunciation.
Well, in French, we say Peru.
Peru. Okay. Charles Peru from Montreal. And Charles, you were following the 200th execution in Texas?
Right.
And tell us about the die-in or reenactment.
That went really great. We were about 20, 25 people over there. We were right in the busy street corner. We had all the media coverage, just about every media was there. And lots of people were totally amazed of what we were doing. They had no clue at first, and then everybody was stopping by and asking me what was going on.
Well, tell me what form that took. I am familiar with die-ins because of the AIDS movement in the United States. And I was an activist in that effort, and we frequently did die-ins. We'd lay down and chalk off the body on the sidewalk and put a name on it. What are you doing there?
Basically, everyone was dressed in black with a black with white mask. But we had also got we put hate on one big board. So we had everyone holding eight names and dates of executions of the 200. So everyone, and we had big signs mentioning about what was going on. Plus, we had what we were calling a big condolence book. So everyone was invited to sign under the message to deliver to Governor Perry.
All right. Now, what prompted you folks in Montreal to do this?
Well, we were looking for something a little more theatrical to get attention of the media because, I mean, the death penalty is not something that bring a lot in the media here. There's more talk in Western Canada with the conservative government that might want to bring it back, but over here it's not talked about as much. So we were looking into something a little more eye-popping to get people's attention. And
well, apparently it worked. You got media. Probably from your report you had more media than the demonstrations here in Texas were able to draw.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I'm not so sure that's such a great news for you down there. But
well, I mean, you know, the thing about the execution in Texas is that it is so ordinary.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, the very existence of Execution Watch, the radio show, was because media basically were letting executions happen and pass this on with one-inch column space in print media and even less in electronic space. Since we've begun, at least a P wire is carried in the local newspapers. But before that was not reliably done.
Okay. Well, we had three of the four major papers covering with photographs. We had the major TV channel over there, and over lunchtime I even had an interview with the right-wing radio down in Quebec City.
Uh-huh.
So we even brought the people's attention back up the road in Quebec City. So
are you an organization, or is this some wonderful artist's idea?
Actually, I work for Amnesty International Francophone branch in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the activism coordinator, but in the volunteer role, I'm DP coordinator for the section. So that was my idea for Amnesty.
Well, congratulations on your creativity, and my congratulations to Amnesty International for their support. And how do people get in touch with your chapter of Amnesty International?
They might visit if people want to get a hold of what we're doing, they can visit our website, Amnesty, but in French, so that would be amnistie.ca /PDM for the French version of death penalty.
Okay, one more time with that.
That's amnistie.ca /PDM.
Thank you very much. We are very glad to have you on the show, Charles. And I won't slaughter your last name one more time, but thank you for joining Execution Watch on KPFT in Houston.
My pleasure to be on the show.
And so that catches up Canadians and people in Huntsville and people in Austin. Any more that we need to talk about this?
Yeah, a couple of things I failed to mention. They also found inside the home on an envelope an unwritten note. He didn't sign. It was a later trial proved it was his handwriting. He wrote, "I am guilty of murder, incest," because he'd have been apparently having sex with his daughter,
apparently
his sister, half sister,
child,
right?
When she killed
"I'm guilty of murder, incest, hatred, fraud, theft, jealousy, and envy." And then they found a diary that he rambled on about what he considered his troubled childhood. And he complained about a absent, disinterested father who he later killed. And then he complained that he had been sexually molested by two stepmothers. And again, I don't know if this was brought in trial. There was not an issue of mitigation submitted to this jury. So I'm assuming it wasn't developed, or they couldn't develop the evidence at trial.
Well, he obviously had a very low opinion of himself.
Is what he said. He said, in fact, he described himself as a monster. In fact, to a newspaper reporter, he described himself as a serial killer, so he had an extremely low opinion of himself.
Scott? Scott?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, you're on the air.
All right. I am standing out here in front of the Wilds unit in Huntsville. We had a protest here. Had about 50 people out here, 40, 50 people. And it was a very moving and lively demonstration that we have come out here and raised our voices to tell Rick Perry on behalf of the people of Texas and the people around the world who have been protesting today in Canada and Austin and Europe that 200 executions is just absurd. And that you need to stop these executions immediately. If you can't do it, you should do it. You know, stop everyone with a 30-day stay. Tell the Board of Bargains and Tolls, institute a moratorium. Whatever you can do, we need to stop executions in Texas.
Okay, are you with an organization, Scott?
Yes, I'm out here with Texas Moratorium Network. I work with CNN and with other organizations today who are working together, such as in Austin, Campaign to the Death Penalty, Amnesty International. In Canada and Leipzig are participating. We have TCADP in Paris and Austin as well. So it's a very much of a joint effort today with people and organizations all working together to raise our voices very loudly, very clearly to tell Rick Perry to stop execution.
Well, from our perspective, we've had reports from Austin and from Montreal and, of course, from Huntsville. And the turnout has been very good, but Montreal is the one that called all the media.
Oh, they had some media up there.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait to see some pictures when I get home.
They did a dramatic die-in approach to the event. And in Austin, they lit the candle, blew the candle out, and rang the bell, all of which are pretty standard symbols of folks who are concerned about the execution issue.
Yes, what we did here was to read off the names of everyone, all 200 now, ending with Terry Hankins. It took quite a while. We had to actually interrupt it because we wanted to be silent while the actual execution was taking place. And there was also some people who brought some white crosses with all the names of the people. We had a prayer at the end of it by a reverend who also honored the victims of the crime that was.
How do people get in touch with your organization?
Well, they can go to the website, www.texasmoratorium.org. It's a hard word to spell, so just do a Google search for Texas Moratorium or Texas Death Penalty, and you'll find it.
And it'll pop right up.
You can call anyone can call me at 512-552-4743, and I'll be happy to talk to you.
Well, we appreciate your being on Execution Watch, Scott. Our regards to the other folks that are demonstrating there.
All right. Thank you very much, Ray.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye. And you're listening to radio station KPFT HD2 channel. You're listening to executionwatch.org. And we've had reports from Huntsville, two of them, and a reporter from, that was Scott Cobb, and we had a reporter from Montreal. and from Austin. The only one that's still out there that is on my list is Gloria Ruback, who is downtown quarreling with the cops over a sound system, which is pretty standard stuff in Houston. Wait a minute, Jim.
I think it's pretty standard for Glory to argue too. I think it works both ways.
I watch her night. She stopped just short of being willing to get arrested over it. I asked them, if you're going to arrest somebody, arrest me first.
You know that you need the money.
I need the money. Actually, I've gotten behind on some of my bills. Jim, is there any indication that since we don't have another one of these things to do until July, that maybe they're going to lighten up a bit?
No. Because the way it works, the TDC really has no control over when the death sentences are set. What happens once a case has been affirmed and all the appeals are over, it goes back to the district court judge, and the district court judge sets the execution date. And that's just happenstance. CDC has no control over that.
Okay.
No agency in the state has any control over it. The one that has control of it.
Dave is with us. Dave, I heard you earlier on KPFD News. Tell me where you are and what's going on.
At the corner of Fannin and South Shore by the Unitarian Church. And we had a fairly decent turnout. We had about 15 people there, which is good for us.
Uh-huh.
And, but what happened with you, Ray?
Well, I tried to get arrested, but that didn't work. Apparently, some officers called around and quarreled with Gloria's sound system.
Where was Gloria?
Gloria was under the hanging tree downtown. And the crowd, when I left, there were, I'd say 12 or 14 people there.
Uh-huh.
And
well, that's close. I mean, so the combined groups, we had about 30 people.
About 30 people in Houston. There was about 50 people in Austin, somewhere between 40 and 50 people in Huntsville.
Wow.
And about 20 people in Montreal, and we've had reports from all those locations.
Yep. That's great.
Yeah, it was a big crowd in Huntsville, larger than usual, but it involved student participation. It was a large student participation in this one.
That's good. That's good. Good to get the students out there.
Right. Well, tell us who you are, about your organization, and what you do when there's an execution.
Well, we have, we're the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. We have, we always have a vigil when there's an execution. Of course, this was a special one with the 200th under Perry, but no matter what the record is, whatever the case, we'll have a group out somewhere in the Houston area. We move it around. We're in four different places right now. We're at that Unitarian Church out in front on Fannin. And our organization, pretty much, we do a lot of educational work, a lot of legislative work, trying to change the minds of people on the death penalty. And I think, you know, with us and other groups that have been working on this over the years, I think we're being successful in doing that. Unfortunately, we've got still have a large number of people on death row, and it seems like Texas is trying to kill them off as fast as they can. So there's not an awful lot we can do about the individual executions. That's the if there's an attorney can hang on to try to change something around, they'll do it. But we want to get out there and show our opposition to certainly this execution today, number 200 under Perry, and any other one that comes along. So we're trying to change public opinion. That's what we're about, Ray.
Okay. How do the people get in touch with your organization? You still kind of officing at the Peace and Justice Center?
Well, no. Our main office for our state organization is in Austin, and then we've got groups in all the different cities. The best way for somebody to get in touch with us is to go to the website and go to, which is tcadp.org, tcadp.org, and you can find out who are the local contacts there on that website and get a lot of good information besides.
Okay, thank you, David. Our regards to the other demonstrators there.
All righty.
And
will do. Thank you.
Thank you. And that was Dave Atwood, and he is at the First Unitarian Church for all of that. Is that Finney? Okay. And Well, it looks like Jim and I've got about 15 minutes here. Jim, I've got a short editorial to do at the end of all of this. So
good after it.
Good.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, it just occurred to me, Jim just brought up an interesting subject, and it's something that I've talked with directors of prisons forever. Actually, the prison system is not responsible for who comes and who goes.
No, it's the district court judges that do that.
District court judges send them business, and one director told me, listen, if I could control who gets in, I would have a whole lot better class content in my prison.
I would imagine so.
Because there are a bunch of these people that I don't want, and there's a bunch of these people that I could release without endangering the public safety tomorrow. And apparently... the fellow that was executed tonight was not a safe dude to put out on the street. At least I wouldn't want to be.
Well, maybe he's killed everybody he disliked. I don't know. There's nobody left.
He was in with, and that was the end of that. But the fact of the matter is, prisons are, they're kind of like septic tanks. Everything comes from somewhere else, and they go there and fester until they run over and get out and are fousted on the rest of us. Prisons as a phenomena does not work. The whole idea of prison does not work. The deal is that we lock people up and say, well, you go learn your lesson and then we'll let you out, except they never learn that lesson. It is not prison that teaches them anything. Once you get to prison, the main thing is that the warden needs to smoothly operate his institution. And you very quickly get the impression that that's what you're there for. Now, if you do that very well, as I did when I was in prison, I became the consummate bureaucrat, and I run the construction department and the maintenance department like any bureaucrat with a job description would do, and I did that very successfully. And so the director of prison and all of the wardens, save one that I met, were anxious and trying to help me get out, and that's not what happened. I filed a writ and got out. But the fact of the matter is, they wished me well on my journey, and I never returned. But that is not true of most people. They go to prison and they are yet integrated into a sausage grinder kind of phenomena, society, where they are there to make prisons work well. And they adapt to that society and fulfill the needs of that society. And somewhere in the process, they forget the needs of themselves and the needs of people who care about them, because the main thing is to make that prison run smoothly. And they adapt to that society, and once that happens, they are specifically ill-adapted to living in other society. Some of those folks graduate on up that they are just worthless cogs in the wheel who do not make any useful difference to anything in their imagination, and they graduate up to death row because, after all, they are expendable, other than to be used as pawns in a much larger game. They have no purpose in life whatsoever. Therefore, in their own mind, their life is worthless. So to a very large degree, the man we executed tonight did not think very highly of himself. He said he was an uncaring mass murderer who committed incest and a myriad of other sins and crimes. And at one point he told a journalist what was going to happen to him is what he expected and what he deserved. That was just the end product. So to a large degree, this man committed suicide with your bucks. And he thought he deserved to commit suicide because he was a worthless piece of crap. And you have no idea how many inmates that I encounter in my journeys in prison who are convinced that they are worthless to nobody except the institution where they serve. They're miserable there, and therefore their life is not worth anything. And they would be more than willing to commit suicide with your nickel if they give them the opportunity. What's wrong is the whole idea. And I've tried to scratch my head and go back as far as I can. I think all prison grows out of the concept of banishment. And I go back to Socrates. Socrates didn't have to commit any crimes, although he was accused of polluting the morals of the young. and he wound up being voted. At that time, the criminal justice system, you could get voted out of Athens. And Socrates was voted out of Athens. They had a big clay pot, and people would pick up a pottery shard, write your name on it, throw in that clay pot, and if you got so many names written on so many shards, then you were banished from the city. And so Socrates got banished from the city, and there was an appeal process, and he took advantage of it, and he went down, and they had a big discussion. The forum is kind of a direct democracy, and he said, no, I know that I am old and ugly and ill-shaped and that I'm annoying, but that's not justification for running me out. And they said, well, you are all of those things. What should be your punishment? He said, how about free lunch? How about giving me a free lunch every day for what I do? Because he was always scrappling around, panhandling for food anyway. Sounds like somebody I know. And so the deal is that out of that grew, we don't have any place to banish them. England tried to send everybody to Australia one time. France tried to send everybody to Guyana one time. And ultimately run out of places to send people that are bad. And so we started building places to store them in a closer proximity to where they came from. And the Quakers said, well, we'll build a place where people can live in silence and be penitent. But only convicts are not largely are penitent lot. And the other thing is that the warden needs somebody to operate his massive prison. So that's what they put the convicts to work, operating this massive prison. And you go to a Texas prison today, wardens don't sit around and say, well, how do we rehabilitate these people? How do we prepare these people to get out in the free world? Wardens sit around, how do I get in this cotton crop? How do I get this equipment to work? How do I keep the sewage plant in operation? And who's going to maintain the lighting and the waterworks? That's what the wardens do. Well, I've got Dan, who's done a lot of time with me. Dan, am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. And we've become cannon fodder for the criminal justice system is what it amounts to. And it's like, you know, for a criminal, Ray, prison is an occupational hazard. You know, that's something you accept. And then you accept that, and then you get in that lifestyle down there. But a while ago, you said something, you know, my favorite poem part of it is those words by Oscar Wilde, the vilest deeds, like poison weeds, grow well in prison air. It is only what is good in man that wastes and withers there.
Well, and the Quakers, who invented Eastern State Penitentiary, and I've been there, looked at that facility. It was called the Walnut Street Jail when they built it. And it was the first penitentiary, they called that the beginning of the utilitarian movement. It was the first penitentiary in the country that was built for people to go lock them up in kind of a banishment thing and let them be penitent until they do better. That didn't work. But 200 years after they built that prison in the 1820s, then they decided that they would do a tour around the country and see what happened to that idea. And a Quaker lady came to Houston and was on the prison show, and she talked to the warden, and she went to the governor's office and talked to him. And that conclusion that they drew is that prisons do not work. And we don't need to have them at all. If they worked, then we would live in a better society. But they said prisons were destructive of the spirits of the people we send there. And tonight's execution is an excellent example of somebody whose spirit had been destroyed. He literally thought he was worthless. He literally did not feel guilty about what he did because he expected himself to do those things. And they said further, it was corrosive of the character of the people who work there. Well, I just saw three cops downtown Houston, and they were so excited about having badges and being able to push a handful of demonstrators around that it was another example of what the problem was. It's the arrogance of power. We sit back and wrap ourselves in some illusion that we are better than other people. But let me tell you something. I am no better than Terry Hankins. I think better of myself than he thought of himself. But as human beings, our ashes will weigh about the same. He is dead. I'm alive. I think I've got important work to do. But let me tell you, every living person has important work to do. You may not have found your niche, but you, by yourself, in your mind, can find solution to the world's problems that are yet to be resolved through politics, through faith for those to whom that is important, and certainly through the work of caring about the people around you, trying to make this a safer and better world. But it is your job, not the job of some warden or building major or field major in a prison. Their job is to operate their prisons, and they are in the business of manufacturing monsters that offer a threat to your safety and security. We have launched a process on the prison show where we're going to go to Washington, D.C. next year with a manifesto of needed reforms in criminal justice. It's a major undertaking, and we have been around the table 3 or 4 times, and what we keep looking at one another and saying is, wait a minute, we're still talking about the color of the drapes or the arrangement of the furniture. We need to do something fundamental in changes here. Let me tell you, every day at the courthouse, lawyers are struggling to improve the quality of justice that their clients experience. That's not the way they would put it. But the way they put it is they're doing their job defending clients in an adversary system. And other lawyers in the same courthouse are doing their job to represent the state. And very quickly in that process, the individuals that are being ground through that system and sent into prison where they become that sausage stuff of operating a prison get lost. We need to figure out a way to value your life, that of your children, that of other people important to you, and all work on a better society instead of work at cross purposes to make this a more dangerous society. My name is Ray Hill. This has been Execution Watch. Jim, any farewell notice?
Can't thank you for saying, Ray. You covered it all.
Thank you, sir. And thank you, Dan, for joining us. I want to thank Elizabeth Stein, who makes all this possible. She is our wizard. She is the producer of this show. Otis McClay is our technical director, and he makes it work because without transistors and other things in that broadcast chain, it doesn't work. Our theme music is written by Victoria Panetti, and that started the program. And I want to thank Dennis Longmire, Dave Atwood, Charles Perrault, and Scott Cobb for being with us. Thank you, Jim Skelton. And this is Execution Watch on KPFT HD2 channel. I am Ray Hill. Good night.